welcome to week four. And week four, I'm going to begin by looking at the British Empire. Now, one of the greatest British historians, Eric Hobsbawm, wrote a series of four books about Britain and Europe, but a lot of it was about Britain. It was the Age of Revolutions, the Age of Capital, the Age of Empire. Those were the three in order, because he thought that in the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, what was the most important things was the French Revolution and the British Industrial Revolution. So he said, this is the Age of Revolution. Those are the two things which help you explain what's happening even in the rest of the world. In the next period, 48 to 75, he said, this is the Age of Capital. This is where we have railways and factories and banks and everything. This is the capital is the most important thing. Then from 1875 till 1914, he said, this is the Age of Empire. There was an empire before, but empire was at the center. This is the time of the scramble for Africa, where Africa is divided among the European nations. This is the time of the war between the British and the Zulus. This is the time of the war between the Russians and the Turkish, with the British supporting the Turkish because they wanted Palestine. You know, the empire was at the centre. And then finally, 1914 to 92, it was the 20th century. And he was a little bit stuck for the title of his book, and he finally called it the Age of Extremes. The Age of Extremes. Now, from one point of view, I find this title a little bit disappointing, The Age of Extremes. You could call the 14th century the Age of Extremes. There was the Black Death. There was the voyages of the Chinese halfway around the world. There was the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. I mean, every century is the Age of Extremes to some extent. So I was a little disappointed. But he is a better historian than me, so I forgive him. So I will be looking at the Age of Extremes in a moment. But first of all, let's have a look at the empire. The British Empire before 1850. Well, it was not the first empire. The British Empire, however, was going to be the biggest empire that history had ever seen. Bigger than the Empire of Mali, bigger than the Empire of the Incas and the Aztecs, bigger than the Spanish Empire, bigger than the Roman Empire, just the biggest. Okay, it's not that. They followed a lot of examples from the Spanish. The Spanish did it first. The Spanish got South America and it was full of gold. And so the English are not very intelligent. So, they've got a lot of gold. Maybe there's gold in the north as well. There was no gold, but, you know, they thought there was gold. The first colonies of the British then, first of all, Madeira, which later became Portuguese, in 1420. And in 1440, the British occupied the Azores, les Îles Azores. But these are quite small. The first colony in North America on the continent was Roanoke. 1585, Roanoke. It was a bit of a failure. Everybody died. They went as a colony to live there, and then they just all died. There was a good reason for this. They were going looking for gold, and they didn't really bring anybody who knew anything about agriculture. So it was a bit of a fail. It's like if we went on to colonize somebody, we'd just all die, you know, basically. The Spanish Empire had certainly caused horrible results on the local population when Columbus landed on Hispaniola, which today is Cuba, in 1492. There were probably 1 million people living there. 50 years later, only 500 were left. This was because of smallpox, the diseases that he accidentally brought with him. The population of Mexico was reduced from 10 million in 1500 to less than 2 million a century later. So the Spanish dominated the sea until the middle of the 16th century, and it was the 1588 was the moment when the British gained domination of the sea. The Spanish sent an armada to try to invade England. They failed, and so that's where we got stuck with. So let's have a look more directly at the British Empire. We're going to jump forward and backwards, Africa, North America, and elsewhere. And we start with this picture here. Looks all right, but does anybody know what it is? I'm sure you don't. I don't know why I say that. I'm sure you don't know what it is, but it looks kind of nice. It's not nice at all. This is a slave fortress. This was built by the British in Africa to keep the slaves until it was time to put them on the boat. So the very central to the British Empire is the trade in enslaved Africans. I'm not going to give you too many details because it's very gore. It's very, very bloody and horrible. The slave trade continued all the way up until 1807. So that's the place where they took them from. Here's a representation of slavery in North America. It was extremely violent. Many people died on the ships. When they arrived in America, they had the auction and they sold the slaves. But if any of the slaves were ill, they just left them to die. They didn't sell. If you couldn't sell them, they just left them there to die on the side. So it's a pretty horrible story altogether. There were revolts, of course. It's very difficult to revolt, but there were revolts. The revolts on the slave ships, occasionally successful. Of course, generally it's a desperate chance. You have very little chance of winning. Also, sometimes the rebellions on the slave ships were too civilized. Really, the only logical thing to do is to kill all the crew except one and make him take you back to Africa. But quite often they were too civilized, and so they made the mistake of leaving a few of the crew alive, and that didn't go well for anybody. Now here are some of the a little bit more cheerful than the slave trade is the abolition of the slave trade. And so here are some of the key dates. And I would say that, you know, certainly the 1807 and 1833, these are dates you need to know. You probably heard them sometime in the past, but you've probably forgotten them. Is that right? Yeah. Forgotten the dates? Yes. Okay, you may not have heard them. Okay, so in 1787 in Britain, there was established the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. This was a very ambitious group of people. The slave trade was huge. The mayor of every town, every local banker, they all made lots of money from the slave trade. It was there's something very important to understand about the slave trade, because the slave trade was so horrible. We kind of imagine, oh, it must be like the heroin trade today, some horrible drug trade made up of gangsters. Not at all. The slave trade was at the centre of the British economy and the French economy, and it was invested in by almost all the respectable people of town. Every mayor of Liverpool for 100 years invested in the slave trade. The Church of England bought large numbers of slaves. And we'll see more of that. It was very, very important. So these people, I think there were 12 of them, 12 men in a room, most of them Quakers from a minority religion, and they said, oh, let's establish an association to abolish the slave trade. You can imagine they went home that evening and their wife said, you're mad. You're just mad. There's 12 of you. How can you possibly abolish the slave trade? It's ridiculous. Now, the campaign in Britain was one of the... There are basically, I think there are four reasons. Tell me if I get to four. I think there are four reasons for the abolition of the slave trade. One, the slave revolts. There were important revolts. I'll talk about a couple of them in a moment, which were obviously not completely successful, but very expensive for the slave owners. The second was the campaign in Britain, a mass campaign, the first ever mass political campaign to exist, national political campaign to exist in Britain. The third reason was that economically there were some ways in which free labour, with workers being paid wages, could be better. Slaves don't, enslaved people don't work well. Of course, why would they? You know, why would they work well? They have no motivation. to work well. So they're always working under the threat of violence. So economically, gradually, some in many places, wage labour was actually better economically than slave labour. And the last one, which is from a just purely historian's point of view, is actually my favourite one, and that is that the people who owned a lot of slaves in the West Indies were in the Parliament in London, the representatives of the slave owners, and there were other groups who hated them for another reason. And these groups said, oh, let's abolish slavery because this will make life very hard for these people we hate. We don't care about slavery. So this I like that. I say I like that from a historical point of view because some things in history are just accidents. And that's beautiful. Not everything, but some things are. So the representatives in the London Parliament of the slave owners had opposition, one, from people who did not agree with slavery, but also from people who thought these people were too powerful and we don't like them. So, first of all, the campaign in Britain, you can see here the logo of the anti-slavery campaign in Britain. It was the first ever national campaign to have a logo. They invented the badge. This is in ceramic. And you can see the slogan, am I not a man and a brother? Ne suis-je pas un homme et votre frère? So a kind of Christian slogan. And here is the slave in chains and on one knee. Okay, it's not Malcolm X. Yeah? It's a very extremely moderate, please. But it was the first mass movement. Tremendously popular in the industrial part of town. In the north, in the industry, where in some of the textile factories, they joined the campaign to abolish slavery, even though their factory was going to have problems because of the cotton not arriving. Here you have some of the statistics about the slave trade, the numbers involved, absolutely huge numbers of enslaved Africans. Now, part of the original reason for this is that in South America and also in North America, it was not possible to make the Native Americans work to grow tobacco and cotton. The Native Americans, in general, preferred to fight a war. And rather than become slaves. However, if the British went to Africa and took some people from here, some people from here, they don't have a language in common, it's going to be very difficult for them to rebel. They don't even speak the same language. And also the cultural violence of moving people across the ocean with such a violence that many of the African languages disappeared. That the people lost their African language. That's how terrible. And this was very deliberate, yeah? And so, although there were slave revolts, it was much more difficult, and it was possible for a couple of hundred years to run tobacco, cotton, and so on. In the southern colonies of North America, it's not yet the United States at the beginning, tobacco and cotton was making millions. Tobacco and cotton. In the north, they made millions from fur and fish, which did not involve slave labour. In the south, they made money from tobacco and cotton. Well, they didn't make money from tobacco and cotton. They made money from enslaved Africans who grew tobacco and cotton. There were a series of revolts, and I can't mention, there are 20 revolts. I can't mention them all. I'm just going to mention two. These are the two most famous revolts. In 1816, in Barbados, in the West Indies, then Bussers Rebellion, and here you can see a statue of him locally out there. I would love to go to see. And in 1831 in Jamaica, Sam Sharp's revolt. The campaign to abolish the results will be eventually the abolition of the slave trade in 1807. Trade. That is to say, if you are an enslaved African, you're still a slave after 1807, but they just can't sell you anymore. So it's better, but you know, it's. And 1833, the abolition of slavery. There were no more slaves in the British Empire after 1833. And when slavery was abolished, the government decided that they were going to pay compensation to the slave owners. They paid the amount of compensation was huge, the equivalent today of billions of dollars, were paid to the slave owners. Now this is an interesting, from a historical and commemorative point of view, this is interesting because they have a complete list of all the people who received money in compensation for the freed slaves. And so today, and the lists have been public and online just for a few years, and so today a lot of white people in England are going to say, oh, did my ancestors have slaves? Oh, fuck. Etc. This has led to some interesting things. I was in a church in Nottingham 2 weeks ago, and in Nottingham Cathedral there's a little thing in the corner, and there's a long list of names, and there is a monument, and it says, we found that the priest of this cathedral owned 23 slaves. Here are their names, and this is a monument to celebrate the lives of these enslaved people, because slavery is a crime against humanity. So you can see that that today, and this we will talk about again, territoire et mémoire, today there are a variety of different ways being tried to try to deal with this horrible past. And that was what, I thought that was quite a good idea, first of all, to actually have the names of the slaves and there's a monument to them. So a lot of things going on there. Now, in Britain, then there was the campaign to abolish slavery. And of course, most of the campaign was middle-class white people. Who has time? Who has time and space and social power? Nevertheless, there were a number of black people involved in the campaign. And the most famous one is Olodo Equiano. He lived in England, and he published his autobiography, My Life as a Slave. And this was used as part of the campaign. He used to go all around the country. Every night he would give a speech. And people would sometimes come for bizarre reasons. People were often very ignorant, and so he would arrive in Manchester, and the people would go and say, I've never seen a black man, I'm going to see, because they'd never seen it. And so it was a big mass education campaign about the abolition of slavery. And he now has a blue plaque, so he's being recognised a little bit. So obviously the slave trade and then its abolition is a huge element of the British Empire in its early days before 1850. The Empire is also the Empire in America, where first of all people leave Britain to go for America for a variety of different reasons. In the North, New England, Pennsylvania, these are people who the founding fathers are people who came from England because they didn't like the religious situation in Britain. They wanted more religious freedom. This is why very often we talk about the Puritans of New England. Strictly speaking, we should say the dissidents, because Puritans are those who want reform inside the Church of England, and dissidents are people who say, I'm leaving the Church of England, more politely than that. So in the North, very often people arrive looking for religious freedom. In Maryland, Queen Mary, Catholic. It's the Catholics founded Maryland. They left England under Elizabeth. So life is too hard for Catholics in England. Let's go to America and found a new colony, Maryland. This was not good for the Native Americans, but it was freer. Pennsylvania. Does anybody know which religious group founded Pennsylvania? It's named after William Penn. That was easy, wasn't it? William Penn, who was the head of the Quakers. So religious freedom was a big motivation for people to go to the north of what will later be the United States. For the south, Virginia, well, that's easy. They went there to make money, and they made money. What did they make money from in Virginia? Tobacco, in Virginia, tobacco. It's written on all the packets of tobacco. Nevertheless, the idea of Britain was that the colonies in everywhere, but in particular in North America, exist in order to help Britain, to help the United Kingdom. And so this became to help Britain, yeah, just for the service of Britain. And so gradually we came on to the big slogan of the American Revolution, no taxation without representation. We live in America. We feel British, but we live in America. We have no members of parliament, zero. But we pay taxes. This is not good. And of course, the end of this will be the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America. Let's have a quick, very brief look at the empire in India. Now, India is huge. It's always been far, far bigger than England and a far bigger population than England. So it's very strange that England should dominate it. For the first couple of hundred years, the idea was not to control India politically, but economically. And the colonization of India was carried out in a rather original way. The Queen gave the power to a private company. It's a bit as if the King of England today said to McDonald's, you can own this country. So the East India Company was a private company with permission from the King, or Queen, I think it was the Queen actually, to tax the local inhabitants and to do more or less whatever they wanted as long as there was money brought back for the Crown. So the East India Company was a private company, but a rather unusual private company, because this was a private company which had an army. Even McDonald's don't have a private army. Yeah? And which printed its own money. East India Company money. 1808. And you see the British coat of arms. Fascinating coins, this. This is the front of the coin. East India Company. And on the back, it's written in, I don't know, but some Indian language, yeah? So the East India Company dominated India, and they conquered India little by little. India was a jigsaw of local princes, and little by little, the East India Company, as a private company, took it over. And the East India Company was a little bit careful. They wanted to make money, and they were a little bit careful. For example, they did not encourage Christian evangelists, Christian missionaries. The East Company, leave them alone with their local religion. We'll take the taxes. You stay away. But this became more difficult in the 19th century. In Britain, there was an enormous revival of evangelical Protestantism. And the desire to send missionaries to India was getting more and more. So there were more and more missionaries to India, and relations were rather tense. There was occasionally a little advantage of having a missionary coming to your part of India, and this was that quite often the missionaries would learn the local language and write it down. These were languages which were not written down. And the missionaries would write it down because they wanted to translate the Bible into the local language. So, in general, being colonized by British Christian missionaries is shit. But there is an occasional advantage, like that you can get a writing set. So the East India Company, this is the headquarters in London of the East India Company. And you can see, this is big money. This is big money, and this is the headquarters in London. And in general, the British elite consider, the Indians are so happy to be dominated by England. The British domination of India is extremely impressive and horrifically racist. For example, the very last British ruler of India in the 1940s was the first British ruler of India who ever had an Indian person come to dinner with him. So for hundreds of years, the British rulers of India never had an Indian person come to dinner with them. That's just a symbol to show it was extremely rigid, old-fashioned racism. Now, like I said, the British in 1830, 1840, 1850, the British elite were in general quite happy and considering that the Indians were satisfied. Many sons of British elite families went to India and came back very rich, very often with diamonds, literal huge diamonds. In fact, the biggest diamond, I think, is in the Louvre now, but it was stolen by the British, and then the French got it. I don't know how, probably by equally dishonest methods. A huge diamond like this, you know. However, the British got a terrible shock. In 1857, they got a terrible shock. The army in India was Indian soldiers with British officers. Most of the army in India, which was fighting for Britain, but the soldiers were Indian, and the officers were British. And it was getting more and more tense. First of all, the missionaries were putting pressure on, wanting people to become Christians. And the taxes were very high, and there was all sorts of reasons. And eventually there came a revolt because there was a rumour that the soldiers believed this rumour that there was something wrong with the cartridges. At the time, if you wanted to fight, you had a gun, you took the cartridge, you bite it off, and then you put it in. And the soldiers came to believe that there was pig fat and cow fat on the cartridges. We don't know if this was true, but the soldiers believed that the British are deliberately making us eat pig fat, which of course, for the local religion, was a terrible thing. And this was the beginning, and this continued into a huge revolt, and the mutineers, the Indian rebels, took control of several big towns. It was a huge revolt. Of course, the British won eventually. You can imagine they had more technology, more money, more guns. But this Indian mutiny was very, very shocking to the British elite. The British called it the Indian Mutiny, even today. Indian historians call it the First War for Indian Independence. It's all a matter of point of view. Now the rebellion, you will not be surprised to hear, was repressed with extreme violence. One of the things they liked to do was to break the body up into different pieces, because in the religion of the people, you could not go to heaven if your body was not intact. And so they wanted to kill them and terrify everybody religiously. Yeah, I mean, the history of empires is no fun. Definitely no fun. When I was in Leeds, I was in the art gallery in Leeds, and I came across this. I thought, that's interesting. This is a propaganda painting. They didn't call it propaganda, about the Indian mutiny. Here is India rebelling. Here is the poor white woman who has been killed by the terrible tiger, and here is Britannia defeating the Indian mutiny. Beautiful propaganda painting from the time. Nevertheless, although they executed many, many people, the British elite were terrified by this rebellion, and they changed everything. Not changed everything. They abolished the East India Society. They nationalized the East India Society, and they established a new situation where the India was governed directly from London by the colonial office. So the East India Company was abolished in just after 1857. And a few years later, they declared Queen Victoria is the Empress of India. Queen of England, and so Queen of the United Kingdom. Yep, Queen of the United Kingdom of Britain and Ireland, and Empress of India. Do you know how often she went to India? Never. She never went to India. She was just the Empress. They organized huge festivals in India to celebrate Queen Victoria. She never went there. I think you get the picture. Let's have a very brief look at the British Empire in Australia and New Zealand. Yes. They abolished the East India Company.
And then they nationalized it.
Well, it's the same thing, really. Nationalising a company is a bit like abolishing it, really. It's no longer a private company. That's what I mean. Yes, it does sound a bit bizarre. Yes, let's say that they abolished the East India Company and established direct rule from London. So Australia and New Zealand. Now, I recommend that you watch the news a little bit concerning Australia in the next couple of months. I say this because one of the questions on the programme is territoire et mémoire, and the question of Aboriginal Australians today is very hot, and this is about the time of year when they write the questions for the capacity. I'm just saying, I recommend you follow it. There is a big referendum in Australia in a few weeks' time. Does anybody know why there is a big referendum? Yes? That's absolutely correct. Yes, it is. So it's what they call a voice for Australian Aboriginals. That is to say, an official organisation which has an official space in the Parliament to represent Aboriginal interests. So it's quite a big reform. It's not as big as many people wanted, but that's going on. Which brings us back to Australia. What happened in Australia? Well, first of all, in the 18th century, Captain Cook, or James Cook anyway, explored Australia. He explored the whole of the coast of Australia. He drew maps, and the reason he was doing it was firstly to get a lot of information for the British Empire. He was a scout, and secondly, he used to go onto the lands of the islands or Australia, and he would take a flag and he'd say, "I claim this territory in the name of the King of England. Now it belongs to England." Now, they didn't ask the opinion of the local people, but that's how they claimed all these places. Australia became a settlement colony, that is to say, a colony where the idea was that a lot of British people would end up living there. This is different from India, for example. In India, the British went to India to work for the authorities, but it was generally for 5 years or for 10 years. There was no intention of establishing in India British villages. Yeah. Whereas in Australia there was. Now, originally these were penal colonies, they were prisoners. Instead of executing prisoners, they sent them to Australia. They established a big penal colony there. That lasted for, I think probably about 80 years. Maybe 60, 70, 80 years. And after that, then they just became settler colonies where more and more people came out to Australia. Obviously, a long period of resistance from Aboriginals, wars with the Aboriginals. But of course, the technology of the local people was they had no proper, they had no guns, so they lost every time. And this has continued. The situation in New Zealand completely different. The first enormous difference is that the Aboriginals in Australia had been there for 60,000 years before the British arrived. The Maori in New Zealand had been there for 300 years before. So it's a completely different situation politically and so on. And this is probably one of the reasons why the situation today for Maori in New Zealand, plenty of problems, but much better than for Aboriginals in Australia, no comparison. And indeed, New Zealand has been working on their idea of a bicultural society. If you go to New Zealand today, and you go into a meeting at a university, a history meeting or something, the speakers will introduce themselves in Maori, and then speak in English. Every university professor will know enough Maori to introduce themselves in Maori as a sign of respect to the original. Oh, very, very different. In Australia, things are changing too. The normal thing to do in either in a trade union meeting or a university meeting or a left-wing meeting or is to begin with an acknowledgement of country. So the meeting begins and you say, hello, you're here for the meeting about insurance. I just want to say that here we are on the land of such and such a tribe, whichever one was locally, and we recognise that this is their land and we thank their elders for welcoming us here. Tout de suite, on sait qu'on n'est plus en Europe quand je suis allé en Australie, c'est très impressionnant. Yeah. So all of these questions are being explored today. So Australia and New Zealand. This is a particular symbol of the situation in Australia. It has to be said, for a very long time in Australia, the Aboriginals could not vote. They didn't have the right to vote. I think it's in the 1970s that they get the right to vote, approximately. You can check it out. There was a horrible kind of a particularly vicious form of racism, because the official policy was, we want the Aboriginals to disappear little by little. Their culture is inferior, said the white elite, and so we want them to disappear. So what they did is that they decided that the children of Aboriginals would be better with white families. And so in the 1950s and 1960s, if you lived in an Aboriginal village, if your children went out to play, sometimes the police would take them and you would never see them again. They kidnapped them and they gave them to white parents who were having problems having... this was many thousands of children. This is what we call the stolen generation. And you can imagine that this is a big deal. They literally just kidnapped people's children. Many years later, probably about 20 years ago now, the government officially apologised. But today there are still people who never found their parents again. Because, you know, not everybody has documents and so on. So there's still people who never found them again. Every year in Australia there is an annual Sorry Day. There is a Sorry Day every year in connection with this. So you can see that these are huge. Yes?
The families that took the children.
Mm-hmm.
They were either
white families who couldn't have children. And sometimes they said, here are some children, their parents are dead. There were a lot of lies going on. Or sometimes they were people who just agreed, yes, you know, the poor things, that they will have a very bad life with Aboriginal parents, because Aboriginals, you know what they're like, you know. So just racist consideration. But yeah, an extremely shocking. There's a couple of very good films about the stolen generation, and a couple of very good autobiographies. To understand, you have to think like South Africa or something. You know, extremely rigid, racist cultures. Okay, so all that was just to summarise briefly some aspects of the empire before 1850. After 1850, we arrived in a new period when now the European countries for a long time had used Africa to capture enslaved Africans, and also for, you know, gold, diamonds, mining and so on. But until the 1860s, there was not a real desire to govern Africa. It was considered to be, it's better just to go and get the valuable stuff and leave, you know. But this changed, and in 1870, there was a meeting in Berlin, and they divided Africa. There were literally no Africans in the room. Yeah, there were Germans, there were French, Belgian, Danish, Italian. Bizarrement, il y a une toute petite colonie danois en Afrique. Je l'ai perdu. And this is what happened by 1914. Then you have this division, and you can see the British have a good chunk. The Germans have these three. As you can imagine, perhaps during the First World War, these were taken by the British or the French, the Italians. So this is what we call the Scramble for Africa, the Scramble for Africa in 1870. And so the whole thing was divided up, except for a couple of places that remained independent. And this will be the situation then for approximately 80 years until Ghana will become independent as the first British colony to become independent. The last little bit of the empire I want to look at is, this is just a YouTube lecture which I recommend. Apart from Eric Hobsbawm, Richard Evans is the best British historian and a very good speaker, really. Amazingly sharp guy, from Gresham. The last section of the empire I want to talk about is Ireland. Now, of course, until 1919, Ireland is part of the United Kingdom of Britain and Ireland. But it was conquered after the Civil War in the 1640s. Oliver Cromwell went to Ireland for two reasons. First of all, he wanted land for his soldiers, and secondly, the Irish were Catholics and might be too friendly to Spain, the enemy. And so there was a extremely violent campaign. Oliver Cromwell believed he was doing God's work. The land in Ireland was taken from the Irish and given to English Protestants. And that will be the situation for the longest time. Now, Ireland is a rather unusual colony because there was a war for independence in 1918, 1919. Usually, if you fight for your independence as a country, you win or you lose. But Ireland half won and half lost and was divided in two. And so in 1919, the British government said, okay, the south of Ireland can have its independence, but Northern Ireland is remaining part of the United Kingdom. And the north of Ireland included Belfast and Derry, the two big industrial cities. They kept the richest part, of course. Now, this goes back a long way. I mentioned Cromwell. There were also a whole series of revolts against the English, and one of the biggest ones is the 1798 Irish Rebellion, and this is a statue of the leader, Wolfe Tone, a statue in Dublin. In the middle of the 19th century, the terrible founding myth of the Irish people, the Irish famine, happened. When I say it's a myth, I don't mean it's not true. I just mean it's more important than its truth. So in France, we have the myth of the French Revolution. There's a flag above every lycée, you know. The French Revolution was true, but it has much more effect. The Irish famine, a quarter of the population died. A quarter of the population left the country, mostly to go to America. So it's an extreme trauma. And today, there are not as many people in Ireland as there were before the Irish famine. And so it's a huge, huge deal. One of the main reasons for the Irish famine is that the ordinary people all ate potatoes. They ate nothing else. They grew wheat, but this was exported to England because it was too expensive. And so the problem of having a large population eating just one thing, you can actually live on potatoes and milk for a very long time. It's quite a good thing from that point of view. So when the potatoes got a disease, suddenly there were no potatoes, and it was a terrible tragedy. This is a monument in Dublin to the Irish famine. There are many Irish songs about the Irish famine, and of course the result was millions of Irish people in America, and quite a lot in England too. There are far more Irish people outside Ireland than in Ireland. Now, this is partly because many Irish people chose to maintain their identity. So if you go to New York, you can meet somebody, say, oh, hi, and tell me about yourself, and say, I'm Irish. Have you ever lived in Ireland? No. Did your parents ever live in Ireland? No. Did your grandparents ever live in Ireland? No. So they're of course, if you're Irish and you live in another country, you can choose. You can continue to be Irish or not. My family came from Ireland, but they decided they didn't want to be Irish anymore. And so they abandoned everything Irish, except they remained Catholics. Yeah, did you mean to come in? They didn't want to become Protestants. Yeah. Ireland. And that's that. One of the. If you have any Irish friends and you want to make them cry, you just have to play them this song, Danny Boy, which is a song. It's a father singing to his son, "You are leaving me. You are going to America. When you come back, I will probably be dead. But say a prayer for me." This is it's very typical Irish lament. Yeah, my grandparents loved this music, and my parents hated it because it was Irish laments. Yeah, Danny Boy.